today we are talking about dogs, and right now we're going to talk to Maya Wei Haas. She's a science writer for NationalGeographic.com, and she's been writing about the research about dogs. So, I mean, in an umbrella sense, Maya Wei Haas, there's kind of what we've always been told, which is, I mean, dog owners, you're a dog owner, I'm a dog owner. You know, we think that our dogs know things and think things, and that our dogs are very aware of our moods, and our dogs know if it's going to be a good day or a bad day. And science has, until recently, tended to come back at us with, you're anthropomorphizing. You know, the dog is a different kind of organism, and it's mainly interested. It's interested in four or five things, but not at the level that you're thinking about. And suddenly, we have a wave of research that you've been reporting on that suggests, oh, maybe we were right all along. So do you want to mention in particular some of the recent findings about what dogs do and don't know?
You know, in general, dogs present a very unique opportunity for us to look at a species that has evolved very closely along with us. And it's sometimes hard to differentiate those, like when you're anthropomorphizing versus, you know, true intentions behind their actions. But dogs are extremely sensitive to our cues, you know, our emotions. I think a lot of people responded to my story on Facebook with anecdotes about, you know, well, I was having, you know, a really bad day or something like that, and the dogs seem to pick up on it and provide comfort during those periods of time. They have evolved because, in part, based off of our interactions with them, and we're kind of their evolutionary pressures. And so some of these more recent studies that I covered in this article have, there are two that I discussed, and one is about social eavesdropping. And so this is kind of the way I was kind of describing it, is like people watching. You see an interaction of people in front of you and kind of assessing general categories of, oh, that was good, that person is nice, or that was not a very good, that person was unhelpful or mean. And it's something that's actually been found in a fair few animals, but dogs kind of hadn't really joined the group at this point. So this most recent study actually suggests that they do, and that they can assess those types of interactions. Now, of course, it's, again, and a lot of the experts I spoke to caution that it's really hard to kind of judge motivation. But in this study, they were looking at several people that were trying to accomplish a task. In one interaction, they had someone actually help, and in the other, the person just turned away when they requested for help. And the dogs seem to shun the person that did not help in the interaction, which is, you know, it really brings up the question, okay, can they tell when someone's mean and directly avoid that person, or can they actually tell a positive interaction?
So the read that the dogs are making is on their owners, right? The dogs are watching this person, other person interact with their owners and trying to, and apparently having some kind of sense of whether this person is being mean to their owners or nice to their owners. One question that would be interesting, I don't know how far into this research they've gotten, but I mean, we know that animals can read body language at an unbelievably subtle level. I mean, that was the whole, that was the whole lesson of the clever Hans fallacy, right? That the horse actually could see all kinds of subtle body cues that the trainer wasn't aware that he was giving. So there's body language. Obviously, also dogs are just keenly, I mean, they have great senses of smell. We may be releasing all kinds of hormones in an interaction. I know, like, if Betsy Kaplan, our producer, is screaming at me, which happens frequently, I'm sure I'm releasing all kinds of, you know, negative sort of fear-based hormones. Maybe the dog's sensing that. Have they sort of tried to control for some of those variables to try to figure out what the dog is reacting to, if the dog, in fact, can notice that a social interaction's going bad for the owner?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, and that's a very good question. And most of the experts that I spoke to about this paper had the same concern, because we do give very subtle cues. One of the things that this group did to control for that was that they made sure that there was no eye contact made with the dog, because generally you can communicate a lot through just looking at their eyes. They also did do a control group where the owner just struggled with the container and didn't actually turn to the second person to request help, and just, you know, struggle with the container and then put it down. And that was the end of the interaction. Of course, we do need more work to really be able to tell and to figure out exactly what they're responding to, because some of the things you mentioned, kind of those subtle, like whatever your body is releasing, the pheromones or whatnot, are hard things to control for. And so it's difficult to tell exactly motivation. But, you know, one of the experts I spoke with did say that it really brings up the question of whether they can categorize these cooperative or non-cooperative interactions without those direct emotional cues. And it really does call for more research to be able to say definitively whether or not that's the case.
All right. So so we've got that. Well, we should say that, and you referenced this and linked to this in your coverage of this, too. I mean, there's been other research that does indicate that dogs can read facial expressions, which is another thing that we might have been told 10 years ago was unlikely, that a dog could actually look at your face and understand what the configuration of the features on your face meant. So that's one of the things you mentioned they have to control for, right? If you're smiling, frowning, grimacing, wincing, the dog may pick that up.
Oh, definitely. And I believe that part of what they tried to control for was not to keep a blank kind of expression. I mean, you know, it's only you can only do that so effectively. But yes, facial expressions are important as well.
Which leads to one of the other forms of research that you looked at. We're talking to Maya Wei Haas, a science writer for NationalGeographic.com. You looked at what's called the gaze following. Explain the gaze following study.
Yeah, so gaze following is another one of those almost instinctual things for us that actually we see in a lot of different animals, particularly social animals, chimps or goats even. If you look in one direction, and you can try this, look in one direction and see how many people, if you're in a big group, will follow your glance in a random direction. And it's just an instinctual reaction for us, because it's kind of that curiosity, and it can signal us to, oh my gosh, I'm about to get hit by a car. For an animal, it could be, you know, there's a predator in that direction. But it could also be, you know, there's something good to eat over there. You know, it has long been said that dogs actually don't do this, and it was kind of confusing. There seemed to be something missing. The author of the study, Lisa Wallace, actually said, like, we know they should do it, we just weren't entirely sure why, whether it was some type of habituation. Like, you know, we look at a lot of things during the day that could be very boring to a dog, you know, computer screens and cell phones and whatnot. And so at some point, perhaps they just stop looking because they get bored of what we're doing. And so this was among other hypotheses that they were testing. And what they actually found was the thing that most influenced this was obedience training, mm-hmm. which, if you think about it, one of the first things you do when you start trying to teach your dog to behave, or even when you first get your dog, is you want them to recognize their name and you want them to focus on your face. And so, you know, you say their name, you tell them to watch, and you're training for eye contact. And so they're not, we've actually trained them out of doing gaze following, because they will look at your face and focus on you rather than look in the directions you'll look. But they found that untrained dogs will follow view off into distant space. They were actually looking at like a door in their room, and the dogs and will follow their gaze into the door, as long as they didn't have much obedience training. And what was even more interesting, actually, and I believe the author said it didn't make it into the paper, but the dogs will actually do what they call as checkbacks or double looking. So if you're looking at the door, the dog will look at the door and then look back at you and look back at the door and try. It's kind of like the dog saying, "Oh, what are you looking at? Like, I know something's going on. Why are you staring at the doors?"
And so, that sort of gets to the kind of primacy of that relationship, right? The dog has substituted the owner for a lot of other cues that a wild animal might be paying attention to. The dog has learned to pay attention mm-hmm. to the owner. And it kind of fits with, and this isn't so much in your article, but it's been much publicized, this other piece of so-called gaze research, which is that owners and dogs, when they gaze at one another, well, we're not surprised to find out that oxytocin, mm-hmm. the so-called cuddle hormone, is released in us. But it's also been, it's in the dogs too, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There were several recent studies that were covered that oxytocin loop, that it's the same reaction that mothers have when they stare at their babies. And it's somehow dogs have hijacked this evolutionary kind of trait that makes us really want to continue to take care of them and, you know, love them. And, you know, actually one of the experts I was speaking to said that this training, the fact that we can train them out of some of these instincts can explain a lot of other studies that we've done with them, because sometimes dogs are extremely hard to work with. There are a lot of variables that we don't know about. And she was saying even like some of the studies, it could explain their differences with chimps sometimes, because, you know, chimps, you don't really want to sit there and gaze into the eyes of a chimp. There's not, you don't get any benefit from that. But when we look at our dogs, we do want to continue to look at them, in part because of the oxytocin loop.
In your article, you talk about an upcoming study. There's an old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So are we going to find out more about that?
Yeah, the results of that study hopefully will be published soon, I believe. It's kind of, you know, based on some other animals and also humans. As humans age, it gets harder for us to learn new tasks as our short-term memory declines. And so, you know, it's the rate that we actually acquire new tasks, it takes a much longer time. And so for dogs, we don't actually know. Some studies have suggested that perhaps that is the case, but they're trying to dig a little bit more into that. And, you know, they also, very little is known about their long-term memories. So their short-term memories are very short. I believe it's something like 2 minutes that they don't remember a lot from moment to moment, which is actually, when I told my husband about this, he was really surprised, because our dog, Oscar, like, he always seems to have a really good memory, but it's not necessarily his short term. It seems to be his long term memory, because, like, right now we live in different cities, and so I'll only see him every month or every couple months. But every time I see him, he, you know, like, tries to wiggle out of the car before we can even get the door open as soon as he spots me. So he seems to have a long term memory. So I would be surprised if they found that dogs didn't have much of a long term memory either. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
My recently deceased dog, Ralph, did on at least one occasion recognize somebody he hadn't seen in maybe 2 or 3 years. The long-term memory is there. And there was just no question that he was recognizing at least something about that person. I was going to ask you that. So you have a dog. You have a dog named Oscar. You're a science writer, but you're a dog owner too. Does all of this research make you think differently about Oscar? Are you starting to think of Oscar as a more complex organism than you used to?
Yeah, you know, my dog, I love him to death, we often kind of would joke about how stupid he was, but the more that I do research and the more that, you know, we interact and we've been trying to work to train him and everything, the more I think he's not so stupid that he's selectively dumb or just, like, pretends to be dumb when he doesn't feel like paying attention to us. They're amazing creatures. They really are. They not only have extreme intelligence, but they also have this domesticated desire to seek our approval and to kind of respond to our every need and whim, and it's just, it creates this lasting bond that is pretty amazing. It's, you know, he's one of our family, and there have been actually other studies that have shown that, I believe it's mothers, their brain activity when they look at pictures of their own dog is very similar to when they look at pictures of their own children, which is just like, they're one of our family. And so, you know, the more I find, the more I don't know if it changes exactly how I interact with him, but, you know, I definitely respect their intelligence so much more. It's very impressive.
I, as a dog owner, I agree. Maya Wei Haas, great to talk to you, science writer for NationalGeographic.com, with the article, Dogs Are Even More Like Us Than We Thought. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll be talking with a Yale psychologist who studies canine cognition, and to our own Teresa Kramer about how she and her dog Maybell became Ivy League students. You just heard a segment about some of the research that's being done into canine cognition. Well, some of that research is being done very nearby, and that in particular means the Yale Canine Cognition Center. Joining us right now is Lori Santos, a professor of psychology at Yale and director of the Yale Canine Cognition Center, also with us in the studio. This is all just by happenstance, but we're recording this interview on a Friday, and it turns out that one of our regular guests on Fridays, or semi-regular guests on Fridays, Teresa Kramer, had the experience of having her dog be studied. Her dog, Maybell, has been studied by the Cognition Center, and I think is going on to do further graduate work with the Canine Cognition Center. But so, Lori Santos, first of all, tell us why there is such a thing as the Yale Canine Cognition Center. How did such a thing come to be?
Well, we started the Yale Canine Cognition Center about 2 years ago, and the purpose of the center is really to study what's going on in the dog's mind. And we do that for two reasons. One is we think dogs are a really cool model for studying human cognition. Obviously, humans are special, right? We have radio shows. There's no doggy NPR that they're listening to, right? We're working on it. I mean, it raises this question of, you know, what is it about the human mind that's special, that's unique? And dogs are a pretty good model, in part because they grow up in the same environments that we do, right? They hear language. They grow up with all this artifact technology in their homes. The question is, you know, how do they end up like dogs, and how do we end up like us? The second reason for studying canine cognition, though, is just like we're interested in dogs for dog's sake. I mean, they live in our homes. We love them, right? We just kind of want to know what makes them tick. And really, the best way to study that is to set up little scientific studies, little problems for the dogs to do, and try to see how they solve them. Really look at the exact strategies that dogs are using to make sense of their world.
And I mean, I think another part of this would be there really is no other animal. I suppose maybe cats are in that category, and then at times other kinds of working animals. But there's no more widespread instance of another species trying to communicate with us and us trying to communicate with. In other words, there's just so much information that's being exchanged all the time. But what we really don't know is how much of the information we put out is being received and whether or not we're receiving the information that we think we're receiving from this animal. I mean, the dog is at a unique apex there, I think.
That's exactly right. I mean, they are evolutionary masters of living in the same world with us and cooperating with us and working with us and so on. I mean, this is how they evolved from their wolf ancestors, right, to kind of be with us. That said, we don't really know that much about how they do that, right? Clearly, they do it quite well. But really understanding how they learn from us, what information they're picking up on, and how we can best relate to them, I think are really important questions.
All right. So I want to talk about some of the specific studies. I mean, one of the other things that the Yale Canine Cognition Center has been able to do is study Teresa Kramer. We need more information about Teresa Kramer. Is she dangerous? Is she like us? So when you brought your dog Maybelle down there, this is actually an experiment Lori really wanted to talk about anyway. But I'm going to have you describe what you saw happen and then have Lori explain more of the context of it. So tell us about the experiment that you did that involved you and a book and your dog.
Okay. Well, it wasn't me in the book. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like there's different. I think I was in the control group where there were two other people in the room, two experimenters. One had a book. She read it for about, I don't know, 30 seconds, a minute, something like that. And she leaves the room and then she comes back. And certain things can happen. She can either put that book down on the ground and then someone comes in from outside and takes that book. In another sort of iteration of this, I would have been the one with the book and someone would have come in and stolen my book. And the goal, I gather, is to find out if the dog will sort of be alarmed that someone has taken your thing and try to tell you about it. And from the sort of debriefing I got, I understood that the dogs do, in fact, react to this and that they go above and beyond for their owner as opposed to the stranger.
So, Lori, how close is that to what you're actually doing and seeing there?
That's exactly right. I think Teresa passed the canine cognition quiz there.
I did bite someone, though.
Yeah, so this is a study we're trying to see whether or not dogs are kind of motivated to inform us about stuff that we don't know about. Do they kind of realize which information we lack and which information we have? And so we did the setup with Mabel exactly as you saw described. Dogs are just sitting there watching a kind of everyday event. There's a person reading a book, either their human companion or just a stranger. And then what happens is that that person puts the book behind them. They can't see the book anymore. And then someone comes and kind of takes the book. It's as though the book is kind of stolen. But it's stolen outside the person's view. And the question is, first, do dogs realize this? Do they understand that the person hasn't seen it? And the second thing is, are they motivated to try to deal with the situation? Do they try to alert their companion or the stranger? Do they try to go get the book back? And we're still, as you can see from the fact that we're still testing dogs on the study, we're kind of in the middle of it. But so far, what we're seeing is that dogs do seem to recognize that people are ignorant in this case. They tend to kind of head towards the door where the the book was stolen. Sometimes they vocalize towards their human companion to try to alert them. It seems like they're really showing these sorts of behaviors, suggesting that they're tracking what we don't know and they're kind of motivated to help us. We designed the study kind of thinking of the old Lassie TV show, you know, where Lassie alerts, you know, oh, Billy's in the well and these things. But what we're finding is, you know, some of these anecdotes that we have about dogs really do seem to be what dogs are capable of and what they're motivated to do.
Right. I mean, every few months in the news, you know, you read about some dog who was who became aware of a fire or something like that and got the owner out. Well, one thing that we do know, Laura, is that if you really aggressively train a dog to do that, so we're asking whether the dog can make a cognitive jump, where the dog can sort of say, I have access to knowledge that the person doesn't have, which is a pretty complicated jump, too. You know, I know this thing, this other organism that I care about doesn't know this thing. It's important that I communicate this thing. I mean, that's a pretty big thing. But we know from guide dogs. I mean, guide dogs do an amazing thing, right? Which is they are trained to understand that a limb sticking out of a tree that wouldn't ever hit them in the head could conceivably hit the person that they're guiding in the head. So what they have to do really is put themselves a little bit in the body of the person that they're guiding and think, oh yeah, his head is high enough, it would hit that branch. To me, that's a really remarkable cognitive feat for the dog to do. That's part of the training. I guess what you're asking is, if you don't train the dog, can it do those things anyway?
Right. Do dogs kind of spontaneously pick up on what we're paying attention to? And as you said, this is a pretty sophisticated ability. In classic work in developmental psychology, this kind of awareness of other people's perspective in some cases doesn't even emerge till around 4 years of age, right? So our dogs are kind of smartly taking into account what other people perceive and realizing that it might be different from their own perspective.
This perfectly sets up what I was going to ask Teresa about. One of your observations after going down to the lab for one day was it seemed as though they were studying some of the kinds of things that Piaget or somebody might have studied about babies.
Right. There's one specific test that Maybell took part in where a toy sort of goes across a stage and then disappears behind a it's not a curtain, but I don't know, a blockade of some sort. And then when that blockade is removed, it's not there, and they want to see, you know, how long the dog looks and if they understand that it should have been there. And I've seen similar tests done with kids. They were sort of testing whether or not young babies can count, but it was almost the exact same test. And I was like, oh, my dog is a 2-year-old child.
Well, I mean, and Lori Santos, I mean, Piaget would call some of that object permanence, right? That, you know, if you can't see an object, is it still there?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah, and that's a really nice observation of a lot of the methods we use. So one trick to studying dogs is that it's harder than studying humans because most humans, you can kind of ask them, you know, where do you think the object is? You know, can't do that with dogs. So one of the methods we use a lot in the center is information about how the dogs are processing events through how they watch them. And one thing we know from human infants is that human infants will tend to look at events more that are surprising. So if you were to see an object disappear, say, you might find that surprising and kind of stare at the event for a long time. So functionally, a lot of the studies that dogs do are a kind of funny version of a doggy magic trick. We sort of sit the dogs down and they get to watch this little show where objects disappear or people behave in weird ways. We're trying to see whether or not the dogs think about those events as weird, and we kind of measure how long they look at them. So we'll have to go back and check Mabel's exact performance. We have to time it, you know, down to frames and seconds to see how she did on that one.
One of the things you're also trying to look at, Lori Santos, is whether or not dogs know when they've done something wrong. So tell us how you try to figure that out.
Yeah, so this is, we're doing some follow-ups now on classic work that was done not at the Yale Canine Cognition Center, but at the lab of Alexandra Horowitz, who works at Barnard College. And she did what I thought was a really lovely study. She asked this question, are dogs really feeling guilty when you see them behaving guilty? Now, you can look on the internet and see very funny videos of guilty-seeming dogs, you know, doing these things with the sort of puppy dog eyes, kind of looking up, feeling bad. And her question was, are dogs really feeling bad, or are they kind of reacting to something else? And so here was her cute study. She brought dogs into the lab with their companions, had the companions tell the dog not to take a piece of food. So they say, don't take this piece of food, don't take this piece of food. And then the dog's companion and the experimenters leave. And so one of two things are going to happen. Either the dog's going to be good and not eat the food, or the dog is going to be bad and, you know, succumb and eat this food. The interesting thing, though, was that then what Horowitz did is that she told the dog's companion different things. So half the dog's companions were told, your dog did great. You know, he didn't eat the food. It was great. Or a dog's companions were told, you know, your dog kind of messed up. He ate the food when he wasn't supposed to. And the question is, when the dog reacts to his companion kind of coming back in the room, what's driving whether or not he gives the guilty look? Is it what he did, like whether he did something wrong or not? Or is it what the companion thinks he did? And what she found, remarkably, was that it has nothing to do with what the dog did. There was no difference between the dogs who were bad and good. What seemed to predict the extent to which they showed these guilty behaviors was what the companion thought. In other words, if your companion thinks you did something bad, you show the guilty look. And I love this study in part because it tells us that sometimes our intuitions about what dogs know are a little bit off. You know, sometimes we get the question, you know, why do we need this canine center? You know, I obviously know what my dog's thinking. And I think sometimes our intuitions are dead on, right? I mean, we get them. We're built to get them. But sometimes we really do need the science to kind of probe a little deeper to see if we're missing something really important about the cues they're giving us.
Well, and it seems to me that one of the things that we learn over and over again is that the cues that we're giving dogs or any animal are really, really important, more so than we think. And sometimes, of course, the cues that we're giving dogs and animals are cues we're not even aware that we're giving. That takes us back yet again to the clever Hans fallacy, where the trainer was, in fact, communicating with the horse in all kinds of ways that the trainer was not aware of. But the way that dogs look to us for cues. So Teresa, you were also, or Maybell, your mm-hmm. dog, was involved in an experiment down at the Yale Cognition Center that involved a bucket and or pails that had treats underneath them. Or explain that one.
Yes. Well, I'm not allowed to actually watch what's going on, but what they explain, I have to put my head down and sit in the corner. So what I believe happened was there was a bucket with a treat under it, and then a bucket that the experimenter sort of made a fuss over and pointed to and showed her, and she was able to see that there was no treat in it. But when I was instructed to let her go, she still went to the bucket that the person had made a fuss over. And this shocked me because she is a food thief and she smells it from very far away and she plots against me to get to it. I would like you to study that because I swear she plans ahead to be able to steal food. And she's got a crazy, crazy nose. So I would have thought she would have been like, yeah, whatever, lady, there's food over there. But she apparently did not.
So yeah, Lori, tell us about this.
Yeah, it's kind of a central question we're interested in, right? Dogs have kind of two ways of getting information, right? Their own sensory systems, what they can smell and what they can see and so on. And then it's the cues that we give them. And one of the questions we're interested in is, which do they prioritize? Now, you might assume it would be in an animal's best interest to prioritize, you know, their own sensory information. But since dogs have grown up with us so closely, it might be that the cues we give them about what they're supposed to do, where they're supposed to look, and so on, are especially profound. And so we have a whole series of studies trying to look at which kinds of cues dogs are prioritizing. Are they kind of watching our actions and what we intend and what we're pointing at? Or are they using kind of their own cues and their own problem-solving skills? And this is another one of the classic findings in the field of canine cognition. It's that one of the things that dogs might be built to do is to use us as good social tools to get information. And so here's a version of a study. You bring dogs and wolves in, and you give them a problem where they're kind of opening a puzzle to get food. And on the first few trials, it's very easy. Dogs and wolves can do it. And then all of a sudden, you make it impossible. They just are not going to be able to figure it out. And the question is, what do they do? Well, what you find is that wolves are really good problem solvers. They have tons of grit. They go at it with trial and error. They do all this stuff to try to figure it out. Very, very motivated to do that. What do dogs do? Well, in the first instance of trouble, they give the puppy dog eyes to their human companion. And, you know, you could interpret that as an evidence of like, well, maybe dogs aren't as smart problem solvers as wolves. Or you could say, no, they're great problem solvers. They know exactly how to get the food. They come to us for help. And so this is why we're kind of interested in whether dogs will kind of prioritize information that people give them, even sometimes over their own knowledge of the situation.
It also raises a question that came up for us on Facebook a little bit when I put this question out, and it's something also that Teresa got interested in. So one of the ways that we understand all of this, I mean, you're talking right now, what's the relationship between the dog and the companion? What does the dog think the companion is? And there are, of course, have been some dog obedience programs and dog obedience books that say, well, you effectively have to be the alpha wolf, right? You have to be the alpha dog. You have to be the leader of the pack. That's really what the dog thinks is happening right now. This is a pack. There's a leader. It's you. Does that, based on all the experiments that you've done, but also the ones that you know about, Lori, does that ring true? Is that what's happening? Is the dog, for example, who can't solve the food-getting problem now looking to the alpha dog for help? Or is it a different kind of relationship? Or don't we know?
I think that's what we're still trying to figure out. I mean, one possibility is that dogs treat it a lot like a parent-child relationship. And by that, I mean children are looking to adults not just to kind of command them what to do or to be dominant to them in a kind of alpha sense, but really to give them information. Their cues in the world about what we should be doing and how we should figure things out. It's how we learn what stuff is, you know, what our norms are, how we should behave, how to solve problems. And our hypothesis right now is that dogs might see their relationship that way as well. So when they hear a command or when they get a cue from us, they're thinking of it not like, oh, I have to do that. It's some imperative. Really, they're thinking in an informational way. In other words, oh, she's telling me something. I'm getting communicated some information. That's what humans do, why we have language, why we have radio shows. We're kind of communicating information. And a lot of these studies are built to try to figure out whether or not that's what dogs are getting from us as well. Do they understand this as information being communicated, or are they merely kind of saying like, oh, this is the dominant one. I should kind of do what they tell me.
So
I think the jury's still out.
Teresa, are you Maybelle's alpha dog?
It's very hard to tell. I'm not real clear on that. She's a pretty well, just naturally well-behaved dog, so I don't have to go around telling her what to do. But
well, you sent me an article that sort of attempted to debunk that whole idea anyway, right?
Yeah, well, I've definitely heard before that, you know, this idea of relating wolves very closely to dogs is just not fair. Because if you leave dogs to their own, like, say, some abandoned junkyard somewhere, they don't actually form a pack structure that's exactly like wolves. They don't. There's not an alpha male and female, and they're the only ones who are allowed to breed, and everybody else just has to do what they say. It's not nearly as close to that wolf relationship. And so it's sort of a question in training. You know, you can either have a communicative relationship, like Lori is saying, based through positive feedback, or you can be Caesar Milan and go around trying to dominate your dog all the time.
Well, yeah, Caesar does believe that the dogs after Katrina formed packs and all that kind
yeah.
of stuff. So, Lori, I have to ask a question that comes up in my household quite a lot. And I don't know, I'd be surprised if Yale Canine Cognition Center has been studying this, but somebody must have, and perhaps you know. Our dog Seamus dreams quite actively. You know, I mean, we see him running. Sometimes we get in the middle of the night, hear him kicking the wall or something because he's having some dream. Well, do we know anything at all? Does anybody know anything at all about dog dreaming? Is it just a canine equivalent of human dreaming, or is it something else? Do we know anything about it?
Yeah, so we know that dogs dream. I mean, just behaviorally, right? We can see evidence that they're showing the eye movements and they seem to be experiencing something. But the question of dog dreaming is one of these domains that it's really hard to study in animals, because the real question we want to answer is, do they dream like us? Do they have these storylines? You know, do they show up at junior high without their clothes on, or, you know, all the crazy dreams that we have and nightmares and so on? And that's really hard for us to ask, because it's really asking about a dog's subjective experience. And that gets tricky. The answers we know so far is that, you know, neurally, it sure looks like human dreaming. Behaviorally, when you're watching it, when you're watching a dog sleeping, sure looks like human dreaming. But to answer the subjective question is actually much trickier than it seems.
No, I would think it would be. The other thing I wanted to ask was, you know, sort of back to the purpose of the Yale Canine Cognition Center is, I'm trying to think how to phrase this, but everything that we've been saying today has sort of triggered a thought in me, which is one of the things that philosophers and neuroscientists are trying to understand right now is human consciousness. How does human consciousness work? You know, and as we begin to look towards artificial intelligence, how can our artificial intelligence be invented that mirrors the qualities of human consciousness, you know, that experiences qualia the same way? The dog's world would seem to be an interesting middle ground, right? I mean, you're looking at the consciousness, kind of in quotes, of a somewhat less complex mind. Like, how does that consciousness work? Does the dog know it's a dog? Does the dog know its name? Is that one of the things that you're really trying to figure out? What's the conscious state of this dog?
I think what we're looking at is how the dogs consciously process information. And that's the kind of thing we can answer pretty well, in the sense that we can look at the kinds of specific decisions dogs make. We can kind of better understand the strategies they're using, kind of how they're processing the information. The thing that's tricky for us is to know how they do it. This idea of qualia, kind of what it feels like to be a dog. And this has been a classic question in the field of philosophy. The famous philosopher Thomas Nagel.
What it's like to be a bat.
What it's like to be a bat. You know, he could have just as easily written what it's like to be a dog. These are the things that we still struggle to find good methods to look at. And, you know, we look into available technologies to try to get at this, using technologies to measure things like heart rate. There's new work by the neuroscientist Greg Burns that's starting to use fMRI technology, so these brain imaging techniques to study the dog brain. But even all the best technologies we have don't have great measures of consciousness just yet. What we use in humans is language, mm-hmm. And that makes it tricky for non-linguistic animals to show us anything of the same sort.
Right, and we still don't understand human consciousness, not even remotely, even with that tool of language, to explore it more deeply. Well, how about a basic question as we head towards the end of this conversation? Does Maybelle know that her name is Maybelle Lori, or might Maybelle simply be a way of getting her attention?
I think we're still trying to figure that one out in dogs. One thing we do know is that some dogs do seem to process words in a much more sophisticated way than I think researchers expected. In particular, they seem to realize that words refer to particular objects, and they seem to learn novel words in some of the same ways as human children do. They seem to understand, for example, that if they hear a novel term, like if I were to give a dog that Mabel the term blicket, for example, and she didn't know what blicket meant, that it has to kind of go with a new object, like new words kind of map onto new objects. And this is cool because it's exactly the same kind of rule that human children use when they're learning new words. So I think we're still trying to figure out exactly how dogs think about the words they hear, particularly their own name, and also whether there are important differences in how dogs do that. Because some super well-trained dogs may process these words in a very different way than dogs who haven't had much training and are just kind of hearing it incidentally. So that's yet another still open question in the field of canine cognition.
All right. We've been talking to Lori Santos, who knows her name is Lori Santos, and she knows that she's professor of psychology at Yale and director of the Yale Canine Cognition Center. Also with us is a journalist and canine observer, Teresa Kramer. She knows her name is Teresa Kramer. We don't know if Maybelle knows that she's a Maybelle. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with a question. What if you don't like dogs that much, and you have to work in a dog-friendly office? Before we begin our final segment, let me just say that today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and Allison Ehrenreich, and we had all kinds of help from all kinds of other people. You know, our parents, our teachers, stuff like that. All right, we're going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to talk about, actually, it's sort of one of the great American taboos, and I didn't really realize that or ever think about it until I read this piece by Corina Zappia. It is called I Was an Amazon Chew Toy. It was written in The Awl. It's just a terrific piece. After we're done with this interview, everybody go off and read the piece, because we won't be able to cover everything. But one of the things that she covers in this is this notion that one of the few things you're not allowed to do or say here in America in 2015 is, I don't like dogs that much, or I'm not that comfortable around dogs. So we're going to start there. Corina Zappia, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And I want to just start there with that. So you've got some allergies, and you had some negative experiences as a very young child with a dog who liked you a little bit too much, right?
Right.
I don't know if you want to elaborate. It's okay to say hump on public radio. I looked it up.
Humbug, okay.
No, hump. Actually.
You know, when I was around 9, I was traumatized by my cousin's unneutered dog, Max. And I used to visit them in Florida, and he would ignore the rest of the family, run over to me, and initiate sex with my leg.
Right.
And I really do think it was because I looked a little like a dog. My hair was black. When I crouched down on the floor, I was about the same height as a dog. And I swear, my cousin just always would let it go on for a little bit too long. So I think I was just kind of traumatized by that experience in general. I do have a little bit of a dog allergy. I'm much more allergic to cats. But to be honest, I've never been a big dog person. And I do feel like it's a little hard in this day and age to admit as such, you know.
Well, I think you can do it. There's one way that you can do it, and I'm guessing it's not in your personality, is to be hyper militant about it. I do know people who are like, dogs are disgusting. Get that dog away from me. And I mean, they do it so aggressively and with such braggadocio and boldness that they somehow or other gain the energy upper hand. But I think you've tried to deal with this in a polite and deferential way. And one of the things you say is the dog owners kind of sniff you out right away.
Yeah, I mean, I do that sad air pat, where, you never really reach the dog's head. And once you say something like, oh, I don't really like dogs, they just, there are some people, their expectation is that it's actually a slight against them.
Mm-hmm.
or that I don't like other dogs, but I haven't met their dog. Their dog is extra super special. It farts rainbows, you know. I mean, and I've just never been a dog person. It's not personal. I just don't want to make out with your dog today. Please don't hate me. And so that's always kind of how I've felt. And when they think, oh, you don't like dogs, it's like, how can you not like my dog?
I think there's also, there's some imputation of that you lack joie de vivre or something, like, you know, or there's almost something un-American, you know. You, what do you mean you don't like dogs? I mean, dogs are just part of our culture, right?
Yeah, for some reason, in some ways, it's okay not to be into kids, but then I'm like, of course you must be into dogs or cats. You know, there's a lot of people who prefer animals to human beings, but to not at least like animals just means you're like this cruel, cold, heartless human being. I mean, I kind of say it in the essay, they're like, well, what does that mean? You know, when a dying baby's in the street, do you kick it till it fits in the gutter? It's like, how cruel can you be not even to like dogs, you know?
Yeah, you were probably cheering when Cecil the Lion got shot last week. You know?
Yeah. I mean, and I don't believe in, you know, animal cruelty. It's just never been my thing, you know? But some people don't even trust others, you know, people who aren't dog lovers.
All right, so you went to work in a place, a very famous place, that was about to institute a very dog-friendly office policy. I should say, just sort of cards on the table, that for many years in my previous radio job, I did bring my dog to work every day, but my dog was, he was sort of sequestered in a radio studio with me, and he didn't particularly, he wasn't very interested in other people, so he didn't really bother anybody, except that there was one person, it happened to be the very famous basketball player Rebecca Lobo, with whom, for some reason, some chemical reason, he had pretty much the same reaction to her that Max had to you. So that was a huge, huge problem, and we're still dealing with that. But so you were working for Amazon at the time. Amazon
right.
was about to move to this fabulous, storied new campus, and
right.
one element of this was going to be that people's dogs were just going to be very welcome and very everywhere, right?
Right. You know, I will say that not as many people brought dogs as I thought. And, you know, I knew the people around me who were bringing dogs. They kind of knew how I felt, so they were very considerate about it. But, of course, the thing is that you can't always plan on a considerate employee. There was an employee after me who I would hear about from other, you know, coworkers and friends who were like, oh, my God, that, you know, dog. We're expected to take care of it when he goes to meetings, you know, the dog isn't potty trained, that kind of thing. So you're really relying on the constant consideration of others. And also, you know, there were rules against, you know, non-potty trained dogs, but who's always going to police that all the time? I mean, more than anything, I just resented the idea that I even had to have a documented allergy with a letter from my allergist. I just think it should be, I'm not against the idea of having dogs in offices. I'm against the idea that there's not an alternative. I mean, if you decide as a company you want to make it dog friendly, you need to have an alternative for people who might not necessarily be into that. You need
right.
to have dog free floors.
Yeah, and so there were all these other different possible accommodations, including at one point you were shown, I think, a map of the new Amazon campus, and then there was this building, this sort of leper colony, right? That was sort of off. Away from all the other buildings, then that was where people like you were going to be put?
No, that was for the severely allergic.
All right.
I was lightly allergic. They knew I wasn't going to, you know, collapse on the floor or whatever if a dog was near me. But, yeah, they wanted me to bring my allergy form back to my allergist to see how allergic I was. So, because the severely allergic were being, I mean, when she showed me that, I was like, oh, my God, they're being sequestered on the, like, edge of campus. It was blocks away from where everybody in my office was. And, you know, I did end up, like, they did end up letting me stay in a dog-free room. It was the only windowless room in the entire floor. I was like, am I in the copy closet now? I don't know. And unfortunately, four other people had to share the room with me.
Right. And so in the article is fascinating just in the sense that there are all this paperwork that you had to fill out and all these questionnaires
yeah.
that you had to answer. And there seemed to be contained. No, it wasn't seemed to be. There was obviously contained in the wording of some of these questions a kind of nudge in the direction of relaxing one's own attitude about dogs. Right. There are all these. Well, you know, it's all going to be a shared HVAC system. Are you sure this patient is really going to be compromised? In other words, you get the feeling that in the way that these questions were worded, there was almost a desire to nudge you, your allergist, and anybody else answering these questions in the direction of going along with the flow of dogs.
Yeah, it was like, you know, is it safe for, you know, me to be in an environment for a limited period of time? If so, please state the maximum of amount of time that your patient may safely work continuously in such an environment. And so it's almost kind of like a game of endurance, you know, where they're trying to break you down. Are you allergic? How allergic? Can they be on your floor, on your side of the building, in the same room, in the same elevator? You know, what about your desk? What if we just set them next to you and then whisk them away? Is that okay? You know, it's just like, you shouldn't even have to prove that. If you don't want to be around dogs all day, if you don't want to, you know, do conference calls with dogs in the same room, I mean, it should be your choice. I think they have to accommodate for all types of employees.
Right. And it seemed as though, I mean, I think the other thing about dogs is that dogs are a little bit unpredictable. I mean, you can leash them, you can do stuff like that. But it seems unlikely that I could guarantee, if I had my dog here, that I could guarantee that you wouldn't have encounters with my dog, right? Dogs get loose and maybe they almost unfailingly run into the one place that you don't want them to run into.
Yeah, no, and I felt kind of bad because everybody had heard about, because I did, you know, I made a fuss about it, and my, you know, coworkers, when they ran into my room, you know, the dog would run into my room, they're like, oh no, I'm so sorry, Karina, and I was like, oh no, I'm like this doggy monster.
Yeah, have you since then sort of thought about this at all? I mean, in other words, I totally respect the fact that you're not comfortable with dogs and that you're honest about it, but it seems as though you pay a pretty huge social price, not only up in your sinuses, but just sort of in the way that you're understood by people around you. I mean, have you thought about the next time this comes up, maybe concealing it even more?
Like in a work environment,
yeah,
or
I mean, you know, maybe I'm sure it comes up in social situations too. Do you still kind of either try to disguise the fact that you're not super comfortable with dogs, or in a very apologetic way let on? I mean, how do you handle this situation now, having been through all this?
I will say, I mean, so people who don't know me as well, who haven't read the essay, I kind of do this like, oh, that's your dog. Okay, you know, and you kind of do that polite smile. And sometimes I prefer not to say I'm a dog hater. I like to call myself a pet neutral.
Right.
I just think, you know, I think there are other people around like me who are just kind of pet neutral, and that's okay.
Did you, in fact, when the piece ran in the All, I didn't read, I'm not even sure what the All does about comments or whatever, but I just read your piece, I didn't read comments. Did you wind up either in that form or in some other context hearing from other people who either were or were not like you?
You know, I'm always a little scared of comments. So
me too.
Because I do want to continue as a personal essayist. But I did, you know, I read some that were supportive. And, you know, some people, like some of my coworkers, you know, who liked dogs, but they were just, you know, they understood not wanting to be around them constantly in a workplace. But I would like to find other, I'm going to call us pet neutrals. I would like to find other pet neutrals out there. I do think we exist, and we're not all monsters.
No, not at all. And the other thing that strikes me is that as corporations become more globalized, and as the workforce becomes more globalized, and you have sort of people thrust together on a campus like that one, who are not necessarily from the U.S., I mean, there are different attitudes about dogs in all kinds of cultures. If you go to Europe, dogs are, if anything, more they're more tolerated and they're more included. And I mean, it's just not uncommon to be in a pretty nice restaurant in Paris and see somebody sitting there with their dog. Dogs just get to go everywhere in Europe. But if you go to other parts of the world, it's just not necessarily expected that dogs will be places. And even if you go to other parts of the United States, dogs are often considered much more outdoor animals. They're not so inside. I mean, it just sort of surprises me that a company would expect everybody to go along with this when you consider that the workforce is getting more heterogeneous, more diverse, not more homogeneous.
Right. I think companies, particularly large tech companies, are all trying to sweeten the pot these days with all kinds of perks. You know, like, look, we have a kegerator in the office. We can totally rage at the office while we write code all night. Look, we have free cafeterias. But I think you just have to wonder, like, what all these perks are sometimes trying to hide. And sometimes I think it's the fact that you will be living at your job.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to make the job place more homey, but no poker can ever really take the place of a decent work-life balance.
Right. So in other words, you might be working 60, 70 hours a week and giving up your weekends, which would make it difficult for you to have a dog in the first place, particularly a dog that's young and that you're training. But guess what? You can just bring the dog to work. And
exactly. Exactly. It's like the free dry cleaning at Google or whatever I keep hearing about. We'll take care of all of it for you here. But, you know, nothing can replace being at home on your couch with your dog, you know?
Oh, absolutely. So, Corina Zappia, I'm glad that you're in a happier space now.
And I
think dog neutral is a very good term, too. There's no reason why you should have to cop to not liking dogs. You're dog neutral. You don't seek them out, but you don't reject them completely.
We just want to each live our lives.
Right. You want your own space, and you want space for them. Thanks for joining us today. But
thanks
once again,
lot.
This piece is called I Was an Amazon Chew Toy. It's still up there on The All. The All, by the way, is spelled A-W-L for people who don't know that. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Colin. Who let the dogs out?